Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
I'm Brian Lehrer. This is my Daily Politics Podcast from WNYC Studios. It's Tuesday, October 5th. Between now and October 18th, the politics in Washington will probably be loud enough to raise the roof. The question is, will it raise the debt ceiling? We're starting today with an explainer about something that could potentially crash the economy that few people understand. NPR White House correspondent Ayesha Roscoe asked President Biden about it yesterday.
So it is possible that the U.S. will not pay its debt. That is possible.
I can't believe that that will be the end result because the consequence is so dire. I don't believe that. But can I guarantee it? If I could, I would, but I can't.
The president couldn't guarantee that the debt ceiling would be raised by the October 18th deadline. But as you heard there, he did assert the consequences of not doing so would be dire. So what's this all about? With me now to answer my questions and yours about the debt ceiling, and by the way, to argue that it should be abolished, is Teresa Ghilarducci, a senior contributor to Forbes magazine on the topic of retirement security and jobs. She's an economics professor at the New School and previously taught economics for 25 years at Notre Dame. She has written several books on retirement economics, including Rescuing Retirement, A Plan to Guarantee Retirement Security for All Americans. Her article on Forbes is called Debt Limit is Silly and Dangerous. Professor Ghilarducci, thanks for coming on for this and welcome back to WNYC.
Yeah, thank you. I'm very happy to talk about the debt limit. It is silly and it's really serious.
So give us a little debt ceiling 101, Professor. What is it exactly? And what would happen on October 18th if it's not raised? Do you agree with President Biden that it would be dire?
I do think that President Biden described it perfectly. The debt limit is a very peculiar American institution. No other major democratic market rich country has such a thing. We've had a limit on how much the government can borrow since the turn of the last century. It's part of our kind of austerian or anti-government sentiment in this nation. But it has not been weaponized for all those years until around 2011. So what it is exactly is that Congress spends money, the president approves the budget, we spend it, the economy, people in the economy, agencies in the economy depend on that money. But it's like charging on our credit card. Our vendors depend upon us paying. But we also have to have this little quirk where Congress also has to pass a law that says that we can borrow money over a certain amount, which is completely arbitrary. It has no economic meaning. If our spending gets to a certain amount and it's indexed, it's not even indexed. It just sits there in this nominal amount.
Let me jump right in right there and ask you a follow-up question that probably a lot of listeners are thinking right now. Because you wrote in Forbes, as you just said, that the debt ceiling has no economic value. So explain further why not. Because if I max out my credit card and ask to raise my credit limit and keep borrowing without having any more income, my personal debt ceiling would have the economic value of preventing me from going bankrupt or not being able to pay the rent. So does it not work like that for more and more borrowing by the federal government?
Yeah, Brian, you went right to the heart of it. Does the debt have any economic meaning? And it does not in the way that you just described. A household is not the U.S. federal government. The government debt and the household debt are very different. Households need to keep their fiscal house in order. And I've been on your show before advocating that people save for their retirement and keep their debt under control. And that's because households can't go to the world market and sell our debt. Japan is not interested in my debt. A pension fund is not interested in my debt. But U.S. government debt, U.S. treasuries, is the most valued asset of governments, of rich people, of endowments, and of pension funds. And it would be quite serious if the U.S. federal government stopped borrowing money and stopped having this high-quality asset in the financial system. So there is a theoretical limit where we couldn't borrow any money because all the world and all the pension funds would say, hey, the U.S. is going to default. But we have never even come close to that sentiment among our lenders. So the U.S. Government, by having a false debt limit that has political meaning, means that the Republicans, it so happens to be the party, can use it as a weapon to threaten Democrats for whatever they want, you know, tax cuts for the rich or to prevent tax increases on the rich, or to make Nancy Pelosi look bad, which this looks like that's happening. You asked me what will happen on October 18th. Mm-hmm. And I think President Biden, you know, got it right. But he didn't talk about why it would be disastrous. On October 18th, we are projected to reach that debt limit. And if Congress does not raise it, then we will have to shut down some operations of the government. And because our society is so unequal and so many people who work depend upon government spending, it will hurt low-income families more than it will hurt high-income families. And that's the disastrous part that I see. Social Security checks will keep being sent out. And doctors will still get paid for Medicare. But if you're a new applicant to Social Security and Medicare, you might not get processed. And food stamps could be stopped.
Let me go ask you to go further on, sure, on that, because you wrote in your Forbes article that the U.S. leads wealthy nations in the percentage of workers in low-wage jobs. And those workers are the most dependent on the so-called discretionary government programs that would have to be curtailed if they fail to raise the debt limit by October 18th. So seniors is one thing. You just mentioned Social Security and Medicare. Those already on those programs wouldn't be affected because those are not considered discretionary programs.
Very good. Right.
So you're talking primarily about working age Americans and their children. So give us more detail about this that a lot of our listeners may not have thought about before, that we lead the wealthy countries in the percentage of workers with low wage jobs. Give us more on that.
Right. And because the debt limit and what Congress does is within the context of what our underlying economy is. Well, we lead the nation. America leads the rich nations in having the highest percentage of our workers working at low-wage jobs. And we have an international standard for that, which is how many workers work below two-thirds the median wage. Now, that sounds like a technical explanation, but it really says, you know, a country has living standards, and how many people are living way below what is considered kind of up, you know, lower middle class, you know, the kind of living standard where you can go to work, dress okay, have a modest, you know, birthday party for your kid. And if you're living two-thirds below that median, you don't have that kind of living standard. So we have about 23% of our workers, most of them are working full-time, are not reaching sort of a lower middle class living standard, not even a working class living standard. They are probably in debt, even though they work, and they depend upon government assistance. If you're working low wage jobs, you most certainly qualify for food stamps. You may qualify for Medicaid for your children, and you may qualify for a taxpayer subsidy called the Earned Income Tax Credit. And we just have that embedded in our economy, and we've led the world in low-wage jobs for 20, 30 years. And if there's anything different about Biden's economic plans, different from Clinton, Obama, Bush, all the rest, it's actually to change that structure. And you can do that by bringing up minimum wage way over $15 an hour, which happens to be two-thirds of median wage. And you can do that by helping unionize. So, I mean, that's part of the underlying current of the Biden administration. Now, why does this matter for this debt limit? The debt limit is essentially political, and it turns out to be a fight between the Republicans that want to stop that that really very progressive plan to make life better for those low-wage workers by raising their wages, and the Democrats who want to continue on the plan. So if your listeners want to understand what's going to happen on October 18th, I would relax a little about whether or not there will be a massive government shutdown that will hurt the economy, even though I put that as a possibility in my Forbes blog. It could cause the recovery from the pandemic recession to slow down. But worry more about the politics, about whether or not the infrastructure bill will pass and whether or not the other reconciliation or Build Back Better agenda passes.
Seth in Englewood, you're on WNYC with New School Economics professor Teresa Ghilarducci, who wrote an article in Forbes called Debt Limit is Silly and Dangerous. Hi, Seth.
Hi, Brian. How are you?
Good, thanks. Go ahead.
Professor, Paul Krugman wrote a piece in the New York Times within the last week or so suggesting that under existing law, the Treasury has the authority to mint a $1 trillion coin and
yes.
to draw down on that account to cover the United States debts. Is that actually possible?
It is actually possible.
He also refers to the...
Yeah, so...
I'm sorry.
Oh, I'm sorry. Seth, were you done?
Raised a protection in the 14th Amendment that he suggested could also be used to avoid this political litigation regarding the debt ceiling. And I'm wondering if either or both of those is possible and what you think the viability of that is.
Yeah, Paul Krugman has been writing that article every time we've reached a debt limit. So it is an important rhetorical point to point out that the U.S. Treasury could get around Congress and mint a trillion-dollar coin, or actually give the authority to the executive branch, to the president, to kind of ignore Congress and say, hey, I know you have this silly thing called the raising the debt limit, but I have this higher authority to pay our bills. And I do mention those two possibilities in my column, but mainly as a political point. There is no other a serious economic debate that suggests that that President Biden is having these two options at the top of his list. It's mainly used by Krugman as a columnist, not so much as a professional economist, to point out how kind of silly and political this debate is. More likely, Congress will raise the debt limit like they have, you know, since 1919. There may be a little pain for people who are on food stamps and who are trying to apply for Social Security, and for the 15% of our economy who are government workers, you know, who might not get paid. I have a neighbor who works for the Smithsonian, and she's really worried, you know, about missing a house payment because she might not get paid in November. So there is real targeted pain that Congress, you know, really should pay attention to, that this won't be shared equally. But it's more likely that we will raise the debt limit than we will print the trillion-dollar coin. But it's a good point to show that in our democracy, we have this battle between a very strong presidency and control of Congress.
Michael in Brooklyn, you're on WNYC. Hello, Michael.
Hi. Adam Schiff tweeted last week, and he said Republicans passed a $2 trillion tax cut for billionaires and corporations, and now they're refusing to pay for it. It's really that simple.
It's really that simple. But Congress caused the debt by stopping the revenue, by slowing down the revenue. And this point is very important. It's not just spending that causes the debt. It's the lack of raising enough money. But it's the things together. It's also paying for military equipment and national parks and not raising the money to pay for it. So it's not quite that simple. It's the spending and the revenue side. But we could solve the debt problem if people still think that's a problem by raising revenue and not cutting government programs. So that's a really important point. It's spending and revenue.
Tweet says, Mitch McConnell on the coin for sure would drive him crazy, and he's the reason it's needed. Another one says Barack Obama, because Republicans would refuse to use it. another one, it's a little dirty, I won't read that one. Another one says, on the trillion-dollar coin, Alfred E. Newman. What? Me worry? Jenna in Westchester, you're on WNYC. Hi, Jenna.
Hi, Brian. Hi, Professor. I have a question coming from a young 25-year-old. I guess my question is, I know that there is so much debt and it seems so high already. Yeah. And my question is, if it doesn't seem like we're ever going to pay it back. So why does it matter if we keep raising the debt ceiling, and why do the dance every couple of years?
Yeah. Jenna, you're spot on. I do want to recommend to listeners my colleague's book called The Deficit Myth by Stephanie Kenner. It really explains the politics and the real economics of the debt limit. But Jenna got it right. It is, since people will buy our debt, as I said, endowment funds, pension funds, you and me value a government bond in our portfolio. Jenna, if you have a pension fund, and you should start saving, part of your assets are going to be a bond from the Treasury, as well as stocks and bonds from companies. So as long as the U.S. Economy and the government is seen as trustworthy to grow and to pay their debt, government debt from the U.S. government will be a very valued asset. I really can't stress that so much. I was on an advisory board in the 1990s of a big pension fund investment, and we were panicked that the U.S. government was going to balance its budget under the President Clinton. That actually caused more economic pain than anybody realized. Because we had no good assets to buy anymore, and we would have to pay more to buy our assets, and we would have to scramble to find a safe asset. So not having U.S. government debt could actually disrupt the world economy in very negative ways.
Jenna, can I ask you, as a 25-year-old, are you concerned that the U.S. government debt will get so big that it will affect your retirement as they borrow more, as Republicans would emphasize, to pay for the retirements of the baby boomers?
Honestly, I don't know that I have enough information to provide a nuanced opinion on the matter, but I say that I think personally I do fear a lot, around, I do have a 401k I've been saving for the first couple of years of my, my full-time job out of school, and I thank you, I do think about the fact that it really concerns me that all of it is just a bet. I am saving all this money, but there is a large part of me that wonders, well, should it be going into a high yield savings account instead? Because there's no guarantee that this money is actually going to be there for me when I need it in 40, 50, 60 years.
Yeah.
Professor Ghilarducci, since you do personal retirement savings advice, what would you tell Jenna about that? And then we'll get back to policy.
Yeah, sure. On that, Jenna, you are doing the right thing. Just by saving 3% of your salary, I hope you're saving a little bit more, but just 3, 4, 5% of your salary for the rest of your life, you will have enough money, even at a modest rate of return, and it will go up and down your whole life when you retire, supplementing Social Security to maintain your living standard. If you waited till you were in your 50s, you would have to save half of your income to even catch up to what you're doing now. Don't worry so much about where your money is right now. Be really concerned about continuing to save. Put it in a balanced portfolio. But if I were you, I would put it in more risky assets, because over time, it will even out. So you should have a few government bonds, but mostly equities. I can't resist saying that. But you are doing the right thing. don't, you're doing the wrong thing if you're worrying too much. We've had plenty of history with generation after generation saving money in American institutions and getting it out in 40 years. And to everybody, Brian, the Social Security will certainly be there when Jenna does retire. There is nothing formidable about solving the revenue problem, and we always have. I have enough faith in our democracy to do that. And our financial markets are stable enough that, you can count on it. It's not 100% guaranteed, but nothing is. Having a diverse portfolio and keep on saving is about the closest you can get to secure your future.
We also borrow a lot of money from China, and comes up from time to time that China is so invested in U.S. government bonds, U.S. government debt, that it holds a lot of leverage over us. And with the competition between the U.S. and China, especially economically, if they wanted to crash the U.S. economy or really damage it, they could just decide not to pay their U.S. government debts. And China has too much power to do that. And that's another reason to decrease the federal debt altogether. What's your response to that?
Yeah, no, I think it's a little bit the opposite. If you owe someone a dollar, they may have leverage over you. But if you owe someone $1 trillion, you know, who has leverage over who? Because the Chinese government really trusts the U.S. government and buys our debt. They buy our debt. It's their assets. And they hope to get those redeemed at some point. They have a stake in the U.S. economy being healthy. They have a stake in the U.S. economy paying them back. So I actually think it's the opposite, that we have leverage over them because they depend upon us paying them back and redeeming our, debt. So, and it's not the most important holder of our debt, but the Chinese government has a lot invested in our ability to pay back that debt.
My guest has been New School Economics Professor Teresa Ghilarducci. She is author of books on retirement security, including her latest Rescuing Retirement, A Plan to Guarantee Retirement Security for All Americans. Her article on Forbes is called Debt Limit is Silly and Dangerous. Thank you so much.
You're welcome. It was really good to talk to you again, Brian.
Brian Lehrer, a Daily Politics podcast, is an excerpt from my live daily radio show, The Brian Lehrer Show, on WNYC Radio, 10 a.m. to noon Eastern Time, if you want to listen live at WNYC.org. Thanks for listening today. Talk to you next time.